This is the audio that accompanies Louis Vuitton versus Hot Diggity Dog. So we look at our first slide here. We get the comparison between the allegedly infringing products and the trademark. These are a series of patterns that Louis Vuitton has a protection for. So these would be picture marks, basically. And Hot Diggity Dog starts selling certain dog toys. Here's a doggy bed, Chewy Vuitton, and it has, instead of the LV, it has the VC, or CV for Chewy Vuitton on it, but it looks fairly similar, right? If we go to the second one here, we have some chew toys for the dogs, and then on the right is another set of the Louis Vuitton patterns that they are claiming a trademark and likely to confusion or dilution by Hot Diggity Dog's products here. And so the final, if you go to three, this is another one of the patterns. I have to admit, I've never seen this cherry pattern before, but I'm not a Louis Vuitton connoisseur. You see the Louis Vuitton pattern on the right. On the left is the allegedly infringing product. And probably with all three of these patterns are distinct, suggestive, really in some ways maybe fanciful. They don't identify purses or clothing by themselves. The patterns themselves have some distinctiveness, inherent distinctiveness, and so I've got a protectable mark. The one thing is this is not really trade dress if we just think of the pattern by itself, but if we think about the shape of the bag, or the bag with the stuff on it, we might be in the useful article doctrine, although I think we could probably separate these two. Or we might be under Wallet versus Samara Brothers. We can probably prove acquired distinctiveness that this is a protectable mark. I think in the end, we're looking at a mark that's a fairly strong mark with strong distinctiveness. So then if we go to slide four, and we can think about both on dilution and likelihood of confusion before we get into the defenses here. The one thing that's interesting in the likelihood of confusion analysis is as the court goes to the factors, we really get a sense how the court defining this as a parody actually helps Hot Diggity Dog a lot, because I think without that, the likelihood of confusion is fairly strong. And in some ways with parody, and we can almost harken back to the Campbell case, the Robertson case, that there, the parody almost requires a lot more copying, and here maybe a lot more potential of confusion to have that critique on the original good. I'm not really so sure that these goods count as parodies, maybe a little more of satire. I'm not really sure what the commentary they're making on Louis Vuitton or status products. In some ways, I think they're really just trying to kind of trade off or conjure on it in some ways. But the court here determines that they're a parody, and so there we start looking at the factors that we look at for likelihood of confusion. The stronger the mark or the more similar the mark, that actually pushes away from likelihood of confusion, right? And the intent part, even though it shows that clearly they were trying to copy, if it's a parody, that pushes away from likelihood of confusion. And the reason I think there's probably a strong likelihood of confusion case here is that Louis Vuitton, not shockingly, makes pet products. So it's not even a case as to whether we have dissimilar goods or services. There clearly are similar goods or services where they use at least one of these patterns to identify them. I'm sure that Louis Vuitton uses the other patterns there as well. And at the very least, it would not be crazy to see someone in this kind of status symbol market expand to pet products, right? Everybody's got to carry their little dog or cat around with them. But in the end, the court decides to not find likelihood of confusion, mainly because the parody parts kind of push against this idea that we would have a likelihood of confusion here. So this then takes us to the dilution analysis. And here, again, the dilution analysis, because the court finds it to be a parody, almost kind of flips some of it on its head, which is going to be weird because there's an actual exception, a statutory exception for parody to dilution. Starting in dilution, one question that actually doesn't seem to be litigated is whether we think Louis Vuitton is actually famous or not, or at least doesn't appear in the opinion part that we took a look at here. It certainly seems for that first and third slide, those patterns probably are not known household-wide. Maybe the second one is, that pattern is fairly well-known. And this now gets us to the actual kind of cause of action, right? What about blurring or tarnishment? And so starting out on blurring, we get a sense of the court's analysis here first talking about how much similarity do we really need, and it's about degrees of similarity. The Starbucks versus Wolf case, we talked about that some circuits require substantial similarity to prove dilution, it's by blurring. But here, the court doesn't seem to kind of dig that deep into it, but kind of talks about parity again, saying, look, the similarity of it is part of what pushes us towards something that we think should be allowable, and thus pushes away from the idea that we would have dilution. And so while it looks like, right, we might have a distinctive, famous, and fairly strong mark, one that's registered, the degree of similarity is more about mimicking because of this parity aspect and not something that would push us toward finding a blurring. And when we look at intent and the association that we're generating here, again, since it's a parity, this pushes us away from the idea that we would find this to be dilution by blurring. So what about tarnishment, right? The argument that they make is that these dog toys are of a low quality because they're cheap, and what happens if dogs choke on them, etc. The court says, look, this is a really, really weak tarnishment argument, and we're not going to take a look at it. Now, one of the things that kind of begs the question about this case is, what about the exceptions, particularly when we go to slide 5? When you take a look at the exceptions, you say, wait a minute, parity is completely identified in C3A two little I. Shouldn't that have kind of short-circuited the analysis here? The reason the court doesn't go into this as an exception is because if you look at the preamble to C3 big A, is that we're looking for nominative or descriptive fair uses where the alleged deluder, is not using the mark as a designation of source. But here, Chewy Vuitton is using that phrase Chewy Vuitton as a designator of source. And so that's why it doesn't work under C3A little 2i. But clearly, because these exceptions are here, I think that's what influences some of the court's analysis and really makes it feel comfortable pushing these dilution factors, particularly when we're looking at blurring, and saying, yes, the similarity is what feeds the parity. The intent was feeding the parity. The association that's already shown by consumers are all about the parity, and we need to provide some protection for parity, even when they're using it as a designation of source. And so the court ends up finding for Hot Diggity Dog. Okay, so that gets us through the two types of infringement analysis, likelihood of confusion and dilution, and some of the defenses to it. What about remedies? The big remedy that everybody wants in trademark cases is an injunction, because I want to stop that possibility of infringement occurring and confusion actually taking place. Right, and so I want to be able to go after individuals for their likelihood of causing confusion. And if I'm able to do that, we're going to find out I'm not really going to have much damages on the back end, because the injunction's the main thing. I'm getting there before harm has been created. And so under Section 34A, I can get an injunction. I can also get profits, damages, and attorney's fees. So what things can I recover? I can recover the defendant's profits, so the money they've made from using the mark. I can also recover any damages that I sustain, and I can actually also get my costs recovered in some way. Typically, I can only get the defender's profits if I can actually prove that they were willful in their violation, they were really trying to trade off and confuse consumers. In most cases, the only damages I'm going to get are the damages that I, as the trademark holder, have suffered. And if all we have is a likelihood of confusion, where in those cases we rarely have really good evidence of actual confusion, it's going to be really tough to prove damages in those types of cases. And so really, a lot of times on the damage end, there's not much of a damage award that's there. You can get attorney's fees for willful violations. We've seen this reversion or flip of the American rule in all of our IP regimes. And one thing that is arguably a little bit unique with trademark is I can get the defendant's profits. But like I said, that's usually not available unless I can prove that I, as the infringer, were really trying and intended to kind of pass off my goods like those as the plaintiff in the case or the trademark holder.